In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the life of one of America's most significant black intellectuals, perhaps the leading black intellectual of the 20th century, W.E.B. Du Bois. And our guest for this hour is historian David Levering Lewis. He's professor of history at Rutgers University, and he has produced a new biography covering roughly the second half of Du Bois' life. This book is titled W.E.B. Du Bois, The Fight for Equality in the American Century, 1919 to 1963. It has recently been published. It came out roughly mid-October. It's published by Henry Holt, and should, of course, be in the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at it. It's a companion to an earlier volume that covered roughly the first half of Du Bois' life, the period from 1868 to 1919, that book titled W.E.B. Du Bois, The Biography of Race. That book won Professor Lewis the Pulitzer Prize. The most recent book was one of the finalists for the National Book Award. As we talk this morning with David Levering Lewis, you certainly should feel free to call in if you have questions. We ask that people try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along, but anyone is certainly welcome to join the conversation. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call for you, use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455, and we'll pick up the tab. So again, locally, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Lewis, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Pleasure to be here.
The first thing I'm struck by is not only the scope of Du Bois' life and achievements, but just how much history he witnessed and how much things changed in America during his life. He was born just a few years after the end of the Civil War and lived until 1963, and died just on just before the March on Washington. What a remarkable sweep of history took place during the time that he was around.
Yes, it's quite a swatch of history, American and really global. And that's what appealed to me when I took on the task of writing the biography more years ago than I would have supposed at the time, back in 1985. The life simply became increasingly the life of our times. Really, it became a life and times biography that was emblematic of so much, both in terms of race relations and the advancement in social science the whole business of commitment to large economic progress in the United States, and then, of course, it spilled over into the ideas of Pan-Africanism, and eventually, of course, as Du Bois became more radical after World War II, it became very much the story of the standoff between the United States and what came to be called the Evil Empire, with Du Bois seeing very little evil about that empire, and indeed, increasingly, Du Bois was an exponent of world communism. So, in those 95 years, you have the real compass of much of the 20th century, and that's why the subtitle is The Fight for Equality and the American Century, because so much of Du Bois's efforts at having an impact in scholarship, in civil rights, and in economic progress reflect both his commitment to the principles and ideals of American democracy, but also his critique of their serious shortcomings and failures.
One other sort of general point, it strikes me that when you look at what most people know about Du Bois and what what young people get in terms of education, that for someone who is such a significant figure, not just in African American history, but in American history, it seems, well, perhaps surprising and perhaps not, that we seem to learn so little about him in school or in any place else.
Well, I hope I don't sound conceited when I say that the consequence of this biography, two-volume biography, is to address just that that silence, that that condition of amnesia. It is puzzling, but I think the reasons are not too far to find. If anyone knows anything about Du Bois, I suppose he or she knows that he wrote a book that has become one of the golden oldies in the American bibliography, The Souls of Black Folk. He wrote that in 1903 at the top of this century, and it remains probably the most eloquent expression of the condition of people of color in the United States. But beyond that, people don't know a great deal. Though once upon a time, I think it would have been true to say that most Americans would have been able to add a few other details to that life. They would have said, well, Du Bois wrote the History of Reconstruction, which, though highly controversial when it appeared in 1935, Black Reconstruction in America has increasingly become a great influence in at least the amongst historians, professional historians, and resonates in the universities. And there'd be other things people would say. I suppose they'd say, "Oh boy, by George, he wrote one of the first studies of urban sociology at the turn of the century, the Philadelphia Negro, back in 1899." But no longer is that true, and I think it's because Du Bois, after World War II, for better or worse, believed that the country was at a juncture, and if it took the wrong path, the wrong course, it would do itself irreversible economic and social harm. He believed that the 1948 election, that messy election in which there were four contending parties. I mean, we think today, as we're very conscious of what's going on in slow motion in Florida, of a complex presidential situation. 1948 was in its own way quite complex because you had, of course, the standoff between the Democrat and Republican parties, Harry Truman running for the first time in his own right as president against Tom Dewey, and then on the far right, the Strom Thurmond Dixiecrats fighting for the maintenance of white supremacy or states' rights as they expressed the issue, and then the Progressive Party movement captained by Henry Wallace. And Du Bois thought that Wallace, the once vice presidential the vice president of FDR, that he represented the progressive forces that the New Deal had launched, and that that Roosevelt, had he lived, would have continued to massage and press forward. Well, we remember what happened. Henry Wallace went down to a crashing defeat in 1948. Truman won with the decisive support of the what was called then the Negro vote because of his very important statements about civil rights. But Du Bois thought that, as important as civil rights were, that economic rights now were more important because civil rights would be only so meaningful as there were economic advancements on the part of the poor and the people of color and others. But when that defeat occurred, it occurred in part because the progressive movement was stigmatized as a communist front. There were, of course, important communist elements in that movement, but it was an easy way to frighten people away from the issues that Wallace verbalized. Mm. Well, after 48, and then comes the Korean War, and we really are into the Cold War in a big way, many progressives and liberals shifted a bit to the right. But Du Bois did not. He remained, according to his lights, faithful to the true progressive agenda. But that agenda increasingly was unacceptable to people in Washington, the Justice Department. And so in 1951, Du Bois was indicted by the Justice Department as the agent of a foreign principal. Acquitted, though, he was, one of the rare acquittals during the McCarthy period, but denied a passport. And refusing to learn his lesson, Du Bois continued to move left. And the issue of race rights became subordinate to the issue of economic rights and global justice. Du Bois seemed to feel that the threat to those ideals was as much a threat caused by the military-industrial complex and the policies of his own country as they were charged to be imperiled by the Soviet Union. And so by the end of the 50s and by the top of the 60s, Du Bois is airbrushed out of history. He's an unperson, uncomfortable, an embarrassment to the very organization he had co-founded, the NAACP, and really very much alone, marginalized on the left. And so now that the Berlin Wall has come down and the Soviet Union is a matter of history, it's possible for us to go back and recapture the man, mistakes and all, and the majestic achievements that he rightly deserves credit for, and to place in a larger and more sympathetic and nuanced perspective this controversial life.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, David Levering Lewis. He's professor of history at Rutgers University. He is probably the leading authority in this country on the life and work of W.E.B. Du Bois, and he has authored a two-volume biography of Du Bois. The first book was W.E.B. Du Bois, The Biography of Race, which was published in 1993, covering roughly the first half of Du Bois' life. That book won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction for our guest. And then he has now just recently published the second volume covering the period 1919 to 1963. That book titled W.E.B. Du Bois, The Fight for Equality in the American Century, published by Henry Holt. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. Du Bois went to Fisk. He graduated from Harvard. He received his Ph.D. there. He was trained in the social sciences. And this was at a time when a number of people, Du Bois included, believed that somehow social science would give us enough understanding of what was happening with race in this country that it would move us toward some solutions. I think over time, he came to believe that, in fact, that wasn't going to do it, that direct action was going to have to be required. And I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about that particular transformation.
Yeah, he came out of Harvard and out of the University of Berlin, which then was considered the finishing school for serious scholars, convinced, as you say, that all you had to do, and of course that was a tall order in and of itself, was to study the problem in an empirical way, and I would stress the empiricism, because that was Du Bois's great contribution to the social sciences, that at the first decade of the century, even then, sociologists were pretty much armchair types and spun theories about the way the world worked. And even those who gave lip service to the inductive way of doing things, going out and actually counting noses, didn't do much of it. Du Bois did, and the Philadelphia Negro was reflective of that methodology. And so he believed he was onto something, and that if he ran a series of symposia inviting specialists on the various topics to do with race and culture in American society, over time, that body of evidence and knowledge would have its impact in the real world. And so from about 1899 until 1910, Du Bois annually presided over the Atlanta studies, which really were a remarkable enterprise, in which every aspect, as I said, of race was looked at: crime, infant mortality, labor, family, religion, so on. And although he got kudos from as far away as, say, Germany and Max Weber, he didn't get much support from the philanthropies, from the great foundations of the day. And indeed, as he looked beyond his classroom and beyond his social science laboratories, it were, things were getting worse, not better, in the area of race in America. And there was one particular trauma for him that focused to him the inadequacy of the scholastic approach. It was a particularly horrific lynching. Lynchings are never pleasant, but this one was really quite ghastly in Atlanta. Almost within the shadow of the university where he taught. And so he thought, as you suggested earlier, that you needed to complement the scholarship with something more activist. And it is at that point that, having already put together a small band of progressive and to some extent militant African Americans who were resisting the spread of Jim Crow from the South to the North, an organization called the Niagara Movement, which opposed accommodationism that the famous Booker T. Washington had defended, with his foot one toe already in the waters of activism. In 1910, he joined with a number of progressive whites to co-found the NAACP, and so he leaves the classroom and becomes the editor of the monthly magazine of that civil rights organization, The Crisis, and will edit it from 1910 until 1934. And he achieves indeed a blend of scholarship and advocacy that is quite rare in American letters. To read Du Bois's editorials is really to be moved by an argument that has so much evidence behind it, so much reason, and at the same time so much passion, surpassingly expressed in prose, that comes charging off the page, that he began to be seen as the NAACP itself. There was no distinction drawn by hundreds of thousands of Americans, black or white, between the organization and Du Bois. He was that organization. And so he was quite effective in mobilizing a new paradigm, a new approach to race relations, breaking away from the rather submissive and patient agenda of the Bookerites, as they were called, the followers of Booker T. Washington, to a position of constitutionalism. Yes, civil rights are guaranteed by the Constitution, therefore they must be ceded to people who are denied them. And that position of integration and full civil rights now became, of course, the agenda of the NAACP, pushed along by Du Bois with a forcefulness that, in the absence of it, I think we would have had an organization that would have got to its main objectives rather more slowly and cautiously.
I think another area in which his leadership was important was in his embrace of the idea of Pan-Africanism. That is, this idea, that this belief that all people of African descent, no matter where they were living, had interests in common and needed to work together. He was very important in organizing a series of Pan-African conferences over the first quarter of the last century. Was this something, his embrace of Pan-Africanism, was that something at the time that was seen as either radical or groundbreaking?
Yeah, both. Mind you, it is derivative, as I point out in the first volume. When Du Bois comes to what comes to be called Pan-Africanism, he does so against a backdrop of Pan movements, Pan-Slavism at the time, Pan-Islamism. It's a time of when nationalism is viewed as a positive, a progressive force. We would have questions about how positive and progressive nationalisms are today. They seem divisive, they seem to lead to balkanization and that sort of thing. But in 1900, when Du Bois first articulated the idea, it was in the context of the Czechs, the Irish, the Poles, the Egyptians, the Serbians, and many others, saying that common culture, language, history, that these things were the constituent elements in the liberation of people. And so Du Bois has that same view. His is for the benefit of, as you say, people of color in the diaspora as well as in Africa. It was, of course, not an idea that called for the immediate end of colonialism, because it quite practically, Du Bois and those rather bourgeois gentlemen and gentlewomen who joined with him knew that the British Empire wasn't going to go away very, very soon, or the French Empire, or what was left of the Portuguese, for that matter. But that the very ideals that those possessing powers, France and Great Britain, embraced for their own citizens, Magna Carta and the rights of man, that those ideas could be used against the colonial powers in order to leverage more autonomy and more rights and greater justice for people in the African on the African continent, and that in time, of course, this autonomy would augment, and imperialism would eventually fade away. And so it was a sort of piecemeal philosophy, but terribly important, because it captured the imaginations of the educated classes of Africa. It had a powerful impact upon in this country, and especially as it was soon embroiled in controversy, because there were soon two Pan-Africanisms, basically the Du Boisian, which was more patient and more realistic, perhaps, and then the Marcus Garvey version, which, in terms of rhetoric at least, demanded an empire, an African empire, immediately, the out-migration of thousands of African Americans to the African continent, the non-collaboration of blacks and whites, and so on. And the debate between the two groups was somewhat confusing to many people who were not quite sure who represented what. But the bottom line was that the combination of the two made Pan-Africanism, whatever the differences between Du Bois and Garvey, very much an issue at play in the United States and increasingly on the African continent.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Perhaps I should again introduce our guest. We're speaking with David Levering Lewis. He's professor of history at Rutgers University and is the author of now a two-volume biography of W.E.B. Du Bois. The newest has just come out, published by Henry Holt. It covers the period from 1919 until Du Bois' death in 1963. The title is W.E.B. Du Bois, The Fight for Equality and the American Century. And again, questions welcome. You can call us 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. You talked a little bit about the fact that that perhaps over time, Du Bois' focus moved from primarily being concerned about the fate of African Americans to what one might say is a more broad kind of human rights agenda.
Yeah.
As part of all this, and actually going back some ways, I think it's interesting to look at his concerns about women's rights and women's suffrage, something that he really wasn't advocating much earlier, much earlier than others, but at a point when perhaps it wasn't the most popular sort of idea.
Yes, he's one of the earliest feminists, I think, and his feminism is a little different from that of some of the other advocates. Say Oswald Garrison Villard, the owner of the Nation, was a feminist, I think one would say, but for most feminists and for most men who espouse such ideas, the concept was largely a political one, and it stopped with the vote. Du Bois is distinct in that for him, his feminism would, I think, be accepted and embraced by, say, Gloria Steinem quite readily. It was the total equality of women, not only in terms of the ballot booth, but the marketplace with equal pay for equal work, and finally, and most controversially, the control that women should have over their own bodies, so that, of course, abortion and procreation became the decision, essentially, of the woman. And in the writings on that subject, Du Bois was well ahead of the curve, and so not surprisingly, he and Margaret Sanger were early co-collaborators and remained that affinity continued through the years. The philosophy of feminism that Du Bois articulated so so boldly and precociously, though, had I found as I began to get into his life more deeply, the personal side of the man, had to be placed aside beside Du Bois's treatment of his wife and his daughter and his relationships with other women. And there I found that Du Bois was such an enormously appealing man to women that he had serial affairs with women of great accomplishment, almost unexceptionally, the first woman to graduate from this medical college, or the first woman to found this magazine, so on and so forth. But it did pose for me a concern as his biographer about the gap between the principle and the practice, which a biographer so often, of course, does encounter, and an apparent hypocrisy. Rather disturbing, I think, to feminists of the day, who are not very forgiving of a man who articulates the rights of women and then at the same time seems to, in some sense, exploit them.
Well, we have a caller to bring into the conversation. Others, by the way, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Urbana, and it's line one. Hello.
Good morning, Professor Lewis. It's a pleasure to listen to you. I remember...
Good morning.
Good morning. I remember another occasion when you were on C-SPAN talking about the first volume of your book with Brian Lamb, and you raised the issue of the Klan in Indiana, and he seemed rather shocked.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you recall that moment, but I do. That's just.
I think I do. Yes.
He was shocked that the Klan was in Indiana.
I think he was.
Yes, I think he was.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Mm-hmm. Well, pardon me for interrupting. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. It was just a passing remembrance, but I wanted to raise what is. At one level, a simplistic question, but I think is not, because it has to do with the way in which Du Bois is conventionally viewed, often in the African-American community in the U.S., the extent to which he's positioned against Booker T. Washington as, with Washington being seen as someone who's willing to deal with the mass of the black population and practical education, and Du Bois as an elitist and oriented towards the Ivy League, and therefore not really a valid representative in some ways of the black community. And obviously his life is a much more complex picture than that, but it's often, I think, misrepresented. These are my views, in the ways in which African Americans can make sense out of his approach to issues.
Mm-hmm.
His focus on, for example, the emphasis on the talented tenth. One of our faculty here, James Anderson, is the author of a book, The Education of Blacks in the South, and he makes the point that Du Bois's emphasis on the talented tenth would, in fact, you know, if you look at the percentage of African Americans who graduated from college in, let's say 1920, in comparison to the 1970s or the 1980s, we're really just getting close. We've just surpassed that goal in recent decades. So his talented 10th proposal is actually a very fairly radical one. I'm just curious as to your views of that whole debate, which gets played out in a very...
You're certainly right that of the many things that bedevil anyone who tries to make sense of Du Bois, it's this concept of the talented 10th, mm-hmm. which is almost inescapably reproached as elitist. Well, it is elitist, of course. I think one just has to own up to the fact that it presupposes that a minuscule minority has a duty to function in a way that excludes the active participation of the masses, quote unquote masses. I think what's important is the motive and what was really in Du Bois's mind. It was not elitism in the sense of snobism and privilege, which made no concessions to progress. Just the reverse. It was an old-fashioned idea that to those to whom much is given, much is expected and obligated, and that this small group of relatively advantaged African Americans, mostly but not exclusively, in the urban North, could have a disproportionate impact upon race relations and the self-concept that the American Negro had of him and herself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just as the Marxist ideology cedes to an elite the obligation to push forward radical change.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, Du Bois's elite was to do the same sort of the same sort of thing. It's also important to point out that this was an evolving concept, and that what Du Bois meant by the talented tenth at the turn of the century is very different from what he means by it by the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, the idea becomes increasingly inflected with a Marxist component. So that in after World War II in 1947, Du Bois formally abjures the notion of the talented tenth,
yeah,
in large part because of the criticisms that are today made of the concept that it had become, he saw, the cover for privilege. It had become bourgeois. And so collusive with the establishment, whatever that was, that its utility was no longer what Du Bois had once hoped it would be.
Mm-hmm.
So he replaces that concept with something far more radical, and he simply indeed confuses the talented tenth, and they part company after the late 40s. But the simple reproach of elitism, I think, is simply inadequate. And
mm-hmm.
Those African Americans who charged that Du Bois was that his ideas were somehow less progressive than Booker Washington's, really, I think, have stood the argument on its head.
Mm-hmm.
Because one concession I think you have to make to Du Bois is that he saw very early on that the maldistribution of wealth was at the root of race and gender,
mm-hmm,
and most problems. This Booker Washington never saw, and the people who followed him did not. Or if they did, they thought that the solution to economics was, in fact, frugality, industry,
mm-hmm,
patience, all the things that are in and of themselves nice enough as constructs, but in the real world, statistically, benefit very few people,
right,
without a lot of help from government and consumers and, you know, cooperative movements, all of which Du Bois was very much pushing.
Hmm. And one final comment. My uncle went to Morgan State for several years, and so this must have been in the late 40s or early 50s. He remembers seeing Du Bois walking around the neighborhood near the campus, and was reports now, in fact, that Du Bois was not a very warm or welcoming kind of personality. That
I'm afraid that's true.
he reports him as being someone who basically looked down his nose at my uncle, who has his own predilection, shall we say. So that was he's not someone who.
Well, hold on. Looking down his nose, no. I think I think I understand Du Bois pretty well now.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I've heard so many stories from John Hope Franklin of Du Bois's flintiness and his arrogance and his aloofness, and I've got no problem with that as his biographer, mm-hmm, conceding that I think those are fair.
Yes,
but they were a bit a function, I do believe, of the man who lives in an imperium of ideas and who has a sense of urgency that if we don't do things now, it'll be too late.
Mm-hmm.
And I think often Du Bois is simply really not aware of, he's very courteous. I mean, he always nods, I gather, and tips his hat and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's simply that he is consumed with the kind of vision that that made him so remarkable, but also so unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
In close quarters, often.
I was recounting that story just as my own family history of an interaction with Du Bois, but I, in general, find him a compelling and very interesting figure, so I'm looking forward to reading your second book.
Oh, I hope you will.
Well, thank
Maybe
you
Maybe I'll
the
give
call.
It to my uncle. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. We have just about... less than 10 minutes left with our guest, David Levering Lewis, who's professor of history at Rutgers and has written a 2-volume biography of W.E.B. Du Bois. The second volume has just been published, covering the years 1919 to 1963, published by Henry Holt, and is in Bookstar now if you want to look at it. And other questions, too, are welcome. We have talked a little bit about the movement toward the left, politically speaking, of Du Bois. You talked a little bit about his support for Henry Wallace in the election of 48. A little bit later, he, in 1961, joins the Communist Party. He leaves the United States, moves to Ghana, eventually renounces his American citizenship, and then dies in Ghana in 63. This certainly led to his estrangement from a lot of former associates and from this organization, the NAACP, that he helped to found and was very closely identified with. How did he feel about that break? And was it something that he mourned, or indeed was he so confident in the direction that he had taken that he didn't really, that wasn't an occasion for sadness or grieving on his part?
I think it was. I think it was an occasion for sadness and but not dismay. And he says some rather salient things about that. He says that on this business of the separation from the people who had followed him and had walked beside him, he said that it was only natural that as a degree of prosperity was acquired by African Americans, there would be class divisions, and in those class divisions, many people would behave in a very conservative and cautious way. They would want to keep what they were acquiring. And during the 50s, of course, was a time when you could quite easily lose what you had acquired professionally if the FBI listed you as unreliable and to be surveillance and all that sort of thing. So he wasn't surprised, but he did greatly regret it, and I was somewhat unforgiving of some of his closest former companions who backed away. But in the main, he remained philosophical because, as you suggest, I think he was. It's the nature of the man to be certain that his choices are, in the long run, if not in the immediate term, the correct ones. And indeed, there is an urgency that comes over Du Bois. After all, he's 80; he can't be around much longer. He would know enunciate this idea of economic democracy and the linkage of economic democracy to what's going on globally, and so that brings him into a critique of the Marshall Plan and of American foreign policy and the Truman Doctrine, which no other African American is making at that time, or certainly not publicly, for the public record. And that has the consequence, though, of simply driving an even deeper wedge between Du Bois and the civil rights community, not to mention the mainstream community. And finally, as you mentioned, he commits the ultimate apostasy of the time, he formally affiliates with the Communist Party of the United States at a time when most of its members are going out the door, leaving it, so that it's down to maybe a few FBI agents and a few stalwarts. Du Bois signs on publicly and then expatriates off to Ghana, West Africa, where the Pan-African idea now has a vehicle for its reification, its fulfillment in this new and apparently very robust regime headed by Kwame Nkrumah. Mm.
We are down, I'm sorry to say, to the point where we have maybe a minute or so left. Now, I know that you have been involved in the research and the writing that led to these books. This has been a very significant part of your life. And you just said to the last caller that at this point you felt like you know Du Bois pretty well. I wonder, as a result of all of this, how perhaps your understanding of him might have changed, or you see him in a light that you hadn't back at the beginning of all of this work.
Yes, surely. In the first place, I think I underestimated the significance of Du Bois. I knew in broad outline the life, but as I got to know it better, I found myself really quite impressed by the industry. Simply the amount of writing and the vitality and the lucidity of the mind. He said once that at 50, had he died, his death would have been celebrated. He would have been celebrated had he died at 50, but claimed, but that at 75, his death was being practically requested. And what that meant was that, unlike most of us who become settled in our ways and our convictions, Du Bois, as he ages, becomes more radical, more venturesome. And that I found simply quite an exceptional characteristic. He was more complex. I was able to appreciate the symbolism of his life, even though though his choices, ideological and geographical, were choices that that I found troublesome. Probably really not the best choices in terms of his own efficacy. But what I came to admire was simply the principled contrariness of this great American.
Well, we'll have to stop there, I'm sorry to say, with much unsaid, and say to you, Professor Lewis, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you very much, David.
Our guest, David Levering Lewis, he's professor of history at Rutgers University. And again, the book is W.E.B. Du Bois, The Fight for Equality in the American Century, 1919 to 1963, published by Henry Holt.